Well, let's get started and let's open in our Bibles to 1 Chronicles chapter 22. Now, I thought I had ideas that maybe we would finish off 1 Chronicles this morning. And frankly, the last couple of chapters need to have a little more time. And so, and I think we've got sufficient time here. We're going to try to finish up 2 Chronicles by the end of May, so that beginning of June we can be ready to start with the next quarter. So, 1 Chronicles 22. Now, since 1 Chronicles somewhat parallels 2 Samuel, right? 2 Samuel is about the reign of David. 1 Chronicles is about the reign of David. And about half of Chronicles is common information, meaning that it's shared with another book in the Old Testament. About half is new information. Now, chapters 22 to 27 in 1 Chronicles, this is all new information. This isn't talked about elsewhere. And so this is David getting ready as he's making preparations for building God's house. Now, last week when we were going through, you know, David had expressed this interest to Nathan. Nathan says, go for it. That night, God comes to Nathan and says, no, can do. Go back and tell him he's not going to be able to do it. And so David is not going to be able to build the temple. But he's going to do everything else but. So he's not going to, and when I say he's going to do everything else but, he's not going to pound the nails, but the nails are going to be ready. So he's got the iron, and iron back in that day, by the way, was very valuable. It, you know, we tend to think of gold and silver as being valuable, and they are, not to foo-foo that away, but iron was very valuable. And so as he is setting aside all of these different things, he's stockpiling all the materials, but we're going to see today that that's not all he does. He stockpiles. He's not just preparing the building materials. He's preparing the people. And he is going to have a bunch of folks set out and designated so that when Solomon gets ready to do his building program, everything's lined up and ready to go. And so, and there's going to be a couple reasons for that. We come out today. We don't know exactly how old Solomon was. Now, how long is Solomon going to reign? 40 years, because Saul, David, Solomon, 40 years apiece. What we don't know is Solomon's starting point. Now, it's interesting because for the rest of the kings, for most of the rest of the kings, it'll talk about he was this old when he came to power, and he reigned for this long. Solomon, we don't get that. And in fact, how's David going to represent Solomon? How's David going to describe Solomon? He's young and inexperienced, which I think may also be part of the reason why David is taking on all of the efforts for making the preparations. We're going to see today, he comes up with the floor plans. So basically, David is creating the blueprints by which the thing is going to be built. He's stockpiling all the materials, and he's got all the people set aside so that all Solomon has to do is say, okay, it's time, let's start. So, 1 Chronicles 22. In fact, what had David just done in chapter 21? We had the pestilence, right? The 3 days of pestilence because of David's sin in numbering Israel. And David has just finished buying the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. And again, the chronicler is talking about that because why? Why is it important to the chronicler about David purchasing the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite? That is the building site of the temple. So David's got where it's going, he's got, and now he's going to start stockpiling. So 1 Chronicles 22, then David said, this is the house of Yahweh God, and this is the altar of burnt offering for Israel. So David said to gather the sojourners who were in the land of Israel. Now when he says the sojourners in the land of Israel, remember that there's a bunch of people who have been conquered, but they weren't exterminated. So they're basically their servants. And so he's gathering all of them together so that they can start doing some of the heavy lifting. He appointed stone cutters to hew out stones to build the house of God. David prepared large quantities of iron to make the nails for the doors of the gates and for the clamps, and more bronze than could be weighed, and timbers of cedar logs beyond number, for the Sidonians and Tyrians brought large quantities of cedar timber to David. And David said, my son Solomon is young and inexperienced, and the house that is to be built for Yahweh shall be highly exalted for a name and beauty throughout all the lands. Therefore now I will make preparation for it. So David made ample preparations before his death. So he is getting everything gathered up together. Then he called for his son Solomon and commanded him to build a house for Yahweh, the God of Israel. Now, there are three main speeches for David in the last chapters of the book. This is the first one, and then the other two are going to be in chapters 28 and 29, which is why we're going to leave those for next week. David said to Solomon, my son, I had it within my heart to build a house to the name of Yahweh, my God. But the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, you have shed much blood and have waged great wars. You shall not build a house for my name, because you have shed so much blood on the earth before me. Behold, a son will be born to you who shall be a man of rest. And I will give him rest from all his enemies on every side. For his name shall be Solomon, and I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name, and he shall be a son to me, and I will be a father to him, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. Now let's just stop right there for a second. What's the verb tense for those verbs where God is describing Solomon? They're all future. So what's God telling David?
Well, it's a guarantee.
Okay, it's a guarantee. Is Solomon born yet?
No.
Oh.
God's telling this to David before there is a Solomon. Now remember, David had a lot of sons. In fact, we're familiar with some of them because, frankly, they're not exactly upright men. And they're all older than Solomon. In fact, when Solomon comes to the throne, the chronicler isn't even really going to talk about it. But one of his older brothers is going to come. Remember that David, because he was old, they sought out a young virgin to help take care of him. And, you know, they don't have relations, but, I mean, she's special because she has been caring for the king. And one of David's older brothers comes and asks Bathsheba, Solomon's mom, hey, can I have her for a wife? Now, how does Solomon interpret that? Wait a minute. One of my brothers is making a move to take this woman to wife. He is trying to take the kingdom. Now, why would Solomon be concerned about that? He had, but why else? Typically, who assumed the throne?
The oldest son.
Yeah, older. Mm-hmm. Not one of the youngsters. Now, David would be familiar with that situation, right?
Right.
because he was the youngest. You know, and so, but here again, God is not only telling him, okay, you're going to have a son. He says his name. Now, does anybody know what Solomon means?
Peace.
Peaceful. It's got the same root as shalom. And so, and why is he going to have that name? Because David's done all the fighting. Solomon's not going to have to do that. So he can be the man of rest, because Dad took care of all the you know, the business with the surrounding nations. And so here you have God coming in and saying, hey, David, no, it's not going to be you, but it is going to be your son. And let me tell you a few things about him. You know, this happens more than you think in the Old Testament.
Joseph.
Okay, so you have Joseph and, you know, his
favored
visions.
Favored by his dad.
Favored by his dad, even though... And why was Joseph favored by his dad? Who was Joseph's mom? Who was Joseph's mom?
Rachel.
Who had been barren, right? And so here's his favorite wife, which, by the way, that's why, you know, you never want to multiply wives, because then you end up with favorites and bad things happen. And so, yeah, can you just imagine, guys, if we were to go home and tell our wives today, you know what, you're my favorite wife. You know, don't try that one. Josiah. Josiah is named. His birth is prophesied in 1 Kings 13, 300 years before he lives. And so, and in fact, we will see in Chronicles how when Josiah starts to clean house and he's killing off the false prophets and the false priests and burning their bones, there are going to be men with him who will say, the man of God prophesied that you would do these very things, and prophesied you by name. Cyrus, the king of Persia, is prophesied 150 years before he lives. That's even in another culture. And so you have all of these, there's all kinds of stuff in the Old Testament in particular, where God, you know, kind of pulls the curtain back a little bit and lets out a detail that here are going to be these things that come, and funny, they all happen exactly as God says they will.
Why does it say in verse 5, David said, my son Solomon is young and inexperienced, and then up here in 9, you will have a son who will be a man of peace and rest. So he has a son named Solomon, but now he's going to have another son.
No, the idea, what's happening here, David is going back. David's telling Solomon about what God told him before Solomon was born.
I see.
And again, chances are Solomon is not that old right now at this point.
15 or something.
He might not be that old.
Mm-hmm. Is this also a messianic prophecy, a man of peace and rest?
Well, you can... By extension, it's going to be that way, because again, God has promised David that your rule is going to be established forever, and Solomon is a continuation of that. But I think part of what is at the point here is that God is making it to where the nation is going to be at rest, and there is a conditional promise that goes with that. We're going to get to that one in just a second. So Solomon's going to build the house. God is going to establish his throne. Now, verse 11. Now this is now my son. So this is like Paul. Here are the facts. Now here's what you do with them. So here's the doctrine. Now here's the application, kind of thing. Now, my son, Yahweh be with you, that you may be successful, and build the house of Yahweh your God, just as he has spoken concerning you. Only Yahweh give you insight and understanding, and give you command over Israel, so that you may keep the law of Yahweh your God. So, can you see perhaps why Solomon is asking for wisdom early on in his reign? And again, can you imagine? In fact, none of us is 25 anymore. Can you imagine being a young man, probably a teenager, and all of a sudden now you're king, and the buck stops with you? You're the one who has to make all of these decisions and all of these choices.
You know, there is another factor here about David preparing all the material, because David gets out of the way and Solomon says, I'm going to build a temple. You guys go do that. You guys go do this. You guys go do that. And you always get that faction in a people that says, why are we spending our time doing this when we should be doing this or that or the other thing? But David's already done all this heavy lifting. It's all stacked up and the drawings are ready. That shows David to be pretty high up in the wisdom category.
Well, he is. He is. And he's anticipating potential difficulties. Ergo, his statement, you know what, my son is young, so let's make sure that we get all this lined up for him. What else is he doing here, though? Who has God been to David? How does David describe his relationship with God?
My God.
My God, right? Mm-hmm. So what does he desire for Solomon?
His God.
Yeah, I want my God to be your God. And again, it's the idea of the personal connection. That's why, again, as he's going through here, you know, yeah, I'm asking that Yahweh's going to give you insight and understanding so that you will obey. There's the application for the knowledge. So it's not just to know about God. It's to know him and to know him experientially by obeying. And if you obey, verse 13, then you will succeed. If you are careful to do the statutes and the judgments which Yahweh commanded Moses concerning Israel, be strong and courageous, do not fear, nor be dismayed. So again, Solomon, you're going to run into opposition. Not everybody's going to think the way that you do. Not everyone is going to think the way that they should. So, man up. You know, to put it in the vernacular of the day, suck it up, cupcake. You don't be afraid. Don't be timid. Be courageous. In other words, what would be another way that you could look at this? Listen, be strong, be courageous, don't fear, don't be dismayed. In other words, lead. Get in front, lead. That's the idea. Now behold, with great pains I have prepared for the house of Yahweh 100,000 talents of gold and 1,000,000 talents of silver and bronze and iron beyond weight, for they are in great quantity. Also timber and stone I have prepared, and you may add to them. Moreover, there are many of those who do the work with you, hewers of stone, craftsmen of stone and wood, and all men who are wise in every kind of work. Of the gold, silver, and the bronze, and the iron, there's no number. Arise and work, and may Yahweh be with you. Now, 100,000 talents of gold. A talent was about 75 pounds. So the idea of 100,000 talents of gold and 1,000,000 talents of silver, there is probably a little bit of hyperbole here, all right? You and I, we live in a day where, you know what? Someone knows exactly how much gold is in Fort Knox. I'll bet you could go somewhere and you could have a number that would come down and say, you know, there are 47,313 pounds and 14 ounces of gold inside this building. Somebody knows that. In their day, I just made that up.
And it could be empty.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be empty. There could be a lot more. I just made up a number. But we live in a day when we have scales that will be accurate down to, you know, grams and, you know, portions of a gram. There's 454 grams in a pound. So, you know, when you're accurate to less than a gram, that's pretty accurate. The idea of, you know, 100,000 and a million, those are round numbers. What's the intent behind it? There's lots. And in fact, you got enough. You got enough here. David also commanded all the officials of Israel to help his son Solomon, saying, "Is not Yahweh your God with you?" So, by the way, he's not just my God. He's not just Solomon's God. He's supposed to be your God too. "And has he not given you rest on every side? For he has given the inhabitants of the land into my hand, and the land is subdued before Yahweh and before his people. Now give your heart and your soul to seek Yahweh your God. Arise, therefore, and build the sanctuary of Yahweh God, so that you may bring the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh and the holy vessels of God into the house that is to be built for the name of Yahweh." Now David became old and full of days, and he made his son Solomon king over Israel. Now, the chronicler is glazing over something here. He doesn't talk about Absalom's rebellion. He doesn't talk about all of the other uprisings that there were as he's getting ready to die. So when he takes and he makes Solomon king, if you go to 2 Samuel, you'll find that, you know, some, this one's done in haste. And so, and in fact, there's a schism in the government. There's factions in the government because Joab is following after someone else besides Solomon. And you've got, some of the priests are going over after someone else besides Solomon. So the chronicler, that's not the issue for him. That's not the thread that he's pulling on. His thing here, David makes Solomon king over Israel. And he gathered together all the leaders of Israel with the priests and the Levites. Now, we're going to go into several chapters here where David is organizing the Levites. And he's organizing different groups. And, you know, again, we look at this and we kind of think, why is this here? Why is this important? And part of that is, When you think about a group, and especially if you're thinking, all right, we're going to send over a brigade of troops, so we're going to send over a couple thousand guys. How do we tend to think of that group? Let me rephrase the question. How do most people tend to think of that group? There is a distinction, because most people are going to think of that group as a bunch of guys. Now, who would think differently about that group?
The quartermaster, who would be sure that they're covered logistically.
Okay. Who else? But the group, can I tell you, we had two sons deployed at the same time for about a month back in the day. Mom and dads think entirely differently about a group that's over there, because that group contains one of theirs. Groups are made up of people. And I think that's part of what the chronicler is getting at here. So when you look here, and the Levites were numbered from 30 years old and upward, and their number by census of men was 38,000. Okay, so there's 38,000 guys. But now they're going to get split up. 24,000 to direct the work of the house of Yahweh. Now, when you read that, since we're talking about pre-construction, how would you interpret that? How could you interpret that? That there's 24,000 for the work of the house of Yahweh. We could be talking about construction, right? Okay. Realistically, though, this is not just talking about construction. This is talking about operating the place. See, David is considering something here, and actually, it's pretty prescient on his part. How has the tabernacle moved up until this point? How's it supposed to move? They carry it. That's right. So all the holy articles, now those are carried by hand. And then you've got all the boards and the curtains and that kind of stuff. And that gets moved with carts, right? But it takes a lot of people to go through and do all of that. There's a lot of stuff that's got to be moved. Well, when the temple gets built, how much stuff has to be moved? Nothing. Because it's in a permanent place. So we don't need to move it anymore. Yeah, so now we got all these guys. What are we going to do with them? So he's starting to make plans for how we're going to use them. So we're going to have guys that operate the temple. And 6,000 were officers and judges. So these guys are going to be handling administrative issues. These guys are going to be handling court cases. That's their job. 4,000 were gatekeepers. Now, I don't think you're going to need 4,000 guys to open and close gates. So chances are these guys are also the security detail. Because there's things to be guarded in the temple. You've got a lot of gold in the temple. You have a lot of precious things in the temple. So this is probably your security detail as well. And check this out. 4,000 were praising Yahweh with the instruments which David made for giving praise. Now, we have an orchestra from time to time here at church. Our church can't even hold a tenth of the size of this band. Try and put 400 people in our building. It's going to be pretty much standing room only. He's got 4,000 people whose job is to sing praise and play praise to God. That's their job. And then David divided them into divisions according to the sons of Levi. And so he goes through it. And again, now we're going to start, here are the sons. And so he's fleshing out divisions. He's fleshing out who's doing what. And some of these names are old. Okay, the sons of Kohath: Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uzziel. Well, okay, so when were those guys alive? Were they alive at that moment? Who was Amram?
Aaron, yeah. Moses.
Yeah, that's Moses and Aaron's dad. When did Moses live?
400 years. 500 years.
Okay. So now here again, the idea for doing this is not just to stick a bunch of numbers in your head, but it helps sometimes if you can kind of have a way to correlate when people are around. So David, if you just think about David, he starts to be king right about 1000 BC. I think it was 1010 BC. And he's going to reign until 970. And then Solomon's going to reign from about 970 to 930. The Exodus is back around 1400 BC. So if Moses is around in 1400 BC, and Moses was how old at the time of the Exodus? He's 80 years old. So he's already been, he'd lived 40 years in Egypt, then spent 40 years out in the wilderness, and then spent another 40 years out in the wilderness, right? And so Amram is probably about 1500 BC. So, and right now at this moment, so yeah, it's 500, 550 years earlier. So these names, he's establishing ties. He's going back to tie into the sons of Levi. Because remember, if you were going to be a priest, what did you have to be able to do?
Prove your lineage.
Prove your lineage all the way back to
Aaron.
And so he's going through here and he is listing out sons. So, go down to chapter 23, verse 24. These were the sons of Levi according to their father's households, even the heads of the father's households of those of them who were counted in the number of names by their census, doing the work for the service of the house of Yahweh from 20 years old and upward. For David said, Yahweh, the God of Israel, has given rest to his people, and he dwells in Jerusalem forever. Also, the Levites will no longer need to carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings for its service. So he numbers everybody, and then, you know, there's a lot to be done. For their station is to be on hand for the sons of Aaron with the service of the house of Yahweh, in the courts and in the chambers and in the cleansing of all holy things, even the work of the service of the house of God, and with the showbread and with the fine flour for a grain offering and unleavened wafers, or what is made on the griddle, or what is well stirred, and all measures of volume and size. And they are to stand every morning to thank and to praise Yahweh, and likewise at evening, and to offer all burnt offerings to Yahweh on the Sabbaths, the new moons, the appointed times, and the numbers set by the judgments concerning them continually before Yahweh. Thus, they shall keep responsibility of the tent of meeting, and the responsibility of the holy place, and the responsibility of the sons of Aaron, their relatives, for the service of the house of Yahweh. So again, there's a lot of stuff that has to be accomplished. Now, here, in a bit, we're going to see next week that when David, before he dies, they have a huge party. And they slaughter 1,000 bulls, 1,000 rams, and 1,000 oxen, I believe. That's 3,000 animals. You ever slaughtered a big animal? Yeah. How long did it take?
This is one case where I'm hoping it's an exaggeration, like the gold.
You know what? On this one here, I'm not sure this one is, because there's a lot of people to feed. And so, once upon a time, we got a buffalo in Colorado, and it took 10 people, 3 hours to skin and bone out a buffalo. And that was with a tractor to hold it up. We butchered a cow, a steer, not all that long ago. Well, I guess it is a while ago, a couple years ago. And how many of us were there? Half a dozen? And it was all day. All day, and that was to do one. So you can only imagine, you know, when all of a sudden now you're talking about doing hundreds and thousands of the, that takes a lot of people. That's all hands on deck.
One thing, real quick, Moses' sons, though they are part of the tribe of Levi, it never mentions them really, whether they did anything at all.
Well, it's actually going to talk about that here in a little bit.
Okay.
Because, in fact, where was that?
It is
back up here in chapter 23. Moses, his sons, get folded back into Levi. They're Levites, but there's nothing, quote unquote, there's nothing special about them. And in fact, even back in the Pentateuch, outside of names, you never read anything about Moses' sons, ever. Which we have to be careful, because some of that's an argument from silence, and you want to be careful about, you know, basing too much stuff off of that. Other than to say this, leadership, and when I say let's use a different word. Godliness is not generational. The sons of Samuel was a righteous man. What about his boys? They weren't. Which was, by the way, one of the justifications used for what?
Getting a king.
Exactly. The people realized, you know what, Samuel? You're really something. But your fruit fell a long way from the tree. And so we need a king, because we can't use your guys.
It's almost like, not to make a broad conclusion, but if your name is mentioned in the Bible, it's because you're either an example of good or an example of evil. The guys that don't get mentioned were the run-of-the-mill guys that probably did what they were, you know what I'm saying?
Sometimes.
It's like your name, if your name's mentioned in the Bible, it could go one extreme or the other.
Frankly, it can go both.
But there was a lot of people that never got mentioned.
Yeah.
That were, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, there were a number who were, to use the word, they were more infamous, right? But again, it's...
I guess what I'm trying to say is we can't assume one or the other based on the fact that they're not mentioned.
Right. But the idea, again, though, I think the one thing that is something about Moses, look, he's from the line of Levi, but God used Moses. God never established anything that said, you know, Moses, you know, you're going to be the line of kings. No. Moses, you're going to be the line of the priests. No. Moses, you're going to be the line of the prophets. No. God used Moses. I think one thing you can take from that is, just because somebody is a godly man doesn't mean that transfers by automatically transfers to anybody else.
God has no grandchildren.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. God has no grandchildren. Okay, chapter 24. Now we're dividing up the Levites. And again, lots and lots and lots of names. And in fact, now they're going to set it up to where there are 24 groups of Levites. And eventually it's going to be 24 groups of 12. So that these guys are going in and doing specific tasks at specific times. So chapter 24, it's Levites. Chapter 25, now we start talking about the musicians. So you have people that are assigned as musicians. One of Carolyn's uncles was a musician in the army during World War II. The army had a band. Actually, the army had a number of bands. And so... that David is going through here. And again, isn't it interesting? In fact, look at chapter 25, verse 1. Moreover, David and the commanders of the army separated for the service some of the sons of Asaph and of Heman and of Jeduthun. So again, these guys are associated with the army as well. In fact, later on, we're going to see that some of these guys, they're actually men of valor. And so we set them out, and these guys, their job is to praise Yahweh. And the number who were skilled in singing to Yahweh with their relatives, all who were skillful, was 288. Now 288, again, is 24 Group 24 groups, 12 each. And they start dividing them out. And then so you see here, here's 24 and 24 groups of 12. Chapter 26. Now we're going to start talking about gatekeepers. And you've got men that are assigned. And again, these aren't just, you know, sometimes you think about, we need to find a spot for so-and-so. He's really not good at anything else. So we're going to make him a guard. You know, and he can go over here and he can guard this gate. That's not how these men are characterized. In fact, as you look, you've got all these lists of names, many of which, by the way, are names that are associated with the musicians. And look at verse 6, also to his son Shemaiah, sons were born who ruled over the house of their father, for they were mighty men of valor. It's not like these guys can't do anything else. In fact, David's taking some of these and he's taking the best and putting them here. Verse 8, the sons of Obed-Edom, they were valiant men with strength for service. Verse 9, Meshelemiah had sons and relatives, 18 men of valor. So again, these aren't the leftovers. These are guys that, these guys could serve in multiple places. David's putting them here intentionally. And then they talk about the gates and where the gates are located. So you've got gates on the different sides.
You get the feeling or the intuition that David knew thousands and thousands of individual men well enough that he knew their skills and he knew their, how he could point them into a position.
You know, that's a great point. Because when you look back at when David was on the run, and again, how long have David's mighty men been with him? This is later in life, but how long had the mighty men been with him? And when did they start?
Well, he was doing like rounds during Saul's reign and protecting the land and pulling off the ites that were on the list.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a long time.
Yeah.
He was playing the harp for Saul and that man just escaped for his life, right?
And David's mighty men were coming to him in the days when he was hiding from Saul. So
it was like 20 or something?
They have been with him for a long time. And again, the idea of, you know, is David familiar with them? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think we talked about a couple weeks ago where David is, they're overlooking Bethlehem and Saul's down in Bethlehem with a garrison. And Bethlehem was where, why was Bethlehem special for David?
It's his hometown.
He grew up there. That's his hometown. And what does he say? Oh, that I could have a drink from the well. And three of his guys go, oh, we can take care of that. And they go fight their way through the garrison, draw some water, fight their way out. Now,
dedication.
That is dedication. And in fact, it's not just dedication. That's love. David's men loved him. Because again, I know we talked about this a couple weeks ago, because doesn't that heighten the betrayal? Uriah the Hittite was one of his mighty men. David knew this guy. That guy had bled for him. And so David is not one of these who rules from an ivory tower. Now, he knows how to be a general. He knows how to be a king. But the fact is, I think part of the reason why David is able to be the way he is with God, because that's the way he was with everybody else. You know, David did show loyalty. Give me an example of David showing loyalty to someone.
Well, he didn't kill Saul when he had the chance.
He didn't kill Saul. He would not raise his hand. He would not lift his hand against God's anointed.
His relationship with Jonathan.
Now keep going with that, because that's the one that I'm looking for.
Mephibosheth.
Mephibosheth. He's lame. And again, in that culture, what was the idea behind being lame? Oh yeah, God's judged you for something, right? And yet, how does David view Mephibosheth? I'm going to show kindness to him. Why?
Because he loves his father.
Jonathan's son.
Yeah. And so again, David's a loyal man. And you know what? When you're loyal, what does that breed?
Loyalty.
And so, you know, David does know. I think David knows lots and lots of different people. And he's going through here, and that's why, and David does something else here too. Who chose? Go back to 25 verse 1. Who made those choices? David and the chiefs. David and the commanders. So in other words, what's David willing to do? Okay, he's willing to delegate. He's also willing to take other people's decisions and run with them. What's that demonstrating?
Trust.
Yeah, trust. Confidence. You know, I trust that you're able to do all of this, and you know what? You've got a list of names? Fine, let's go with them. What's it like to work for a boss like that?
It's freedom.
Yeah.
It's liberating.
Sometimes I feel the curses of being self-employed. I know my boss. He's a knucklehead. So again, these are just different things that you can see about David that you see what he does, and then you can compare that with other sections of scripture that have talked about him, and you can start to glean some of the different characteristics that he has. So again, being a man after God's own heart, that is a great thing to strive for. But what does it look like? And you can start to see here how that is demonstrated in a number of ways. So, that's how that is. So number one, you know, can I recognize it if I see it? And secondly, what else could you use that as? You can use that as a barometer for yourself. Do I do these things? Would someone else say these things of me? And so, you know, giving you an idea as to being able to gauge where you're at. So chapter 26, verse 20, as for the Levites, Ahijah was over the treasures of the house of God and of the treasures of the holy gifts. Now, so you're going to have guys that are watching the gates. If you go over to England and you go to the outside of one of the castles, what are you going to see posted on the outside of the castles? Who are you going to see posted? Yeah, there's going to be guards. And they look kind of ceremonial, don't they? Because they've got particular outfits. And in fact, you go to some places, even their weapons are ceremonial. Now, inside of most castles, there's going to be something of value, right? Do you think the guys on the outside are the only ones guarding the castle? Probably not. And the guys that are on the inside, are they going to be in the fancy uniforms? Probably not. And are their weapons going to be ceremonial? Probably not. So that's the idea here. You've got gatekeepers, but then you've got the guys who are making sure that nobody's going to be storming the gates. Because the assumption is, if you're storming the gate, why would you do that? Well, you're coming in to get something that's inside. And we are here to make sure that you do not do such a thing.
I don't think we should assume that those guys in the funny uniforms are pushovers.
They're not. They're not. But I'll guarantee you the guys behind them. You know, there's a lot of... if you're going to be a guard for the Tomb of the Unknown, it specifies your size. It specifies your waist. It specifies everything. And in fact, it's really, I don't know if you've ever looked. You can go on YouTube and get a video that talks about if you serve as a guard at the Tomb of the Unknown, you can't drink. Ever. That means after you leave. Because you are not to do anything that would bring shame to the fact that you are a guard for the unknown. And those guys, they practice, 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 practice. And they're wonderful troops, but they're pretty boys too.
The worst thing I heard, you know, and you follow the actions of our so-called government. The worst thing I heard last week was they dropped the words duty, honor, country from the mission statement at West Point.
Well, yeah. Point here being, David's making all of these preparations, and he's not leaving anything out, is he? When you look at this, you know, would I have necessarily thought of all of these different things? No. David is. And so, and again, what's inside? Well, that stuff that David and the heads of the father's household, the commander, this is chapter 26, verse 26. So, which King David, heads of the father's households, the commanders of thousands and hundreds, the commanders of the army had set apart as holy. So when these guys go out to war and they come back with spoils of war, many of them are bringing that stuff in and they're dedicating it to God. Well, it's got to be stored somewhere. And the temple is where it's going to be stored. And jump down to, so verse 27, they set apart as holy part of what was won in battles and part of the spoil to repair the house of Yahweh. Verse 28, and all that Samuel the seer had set apart as holy, and Saul the son of Kish, Abner the son of Ner, and Joab the son of Zariah, everyone who had set apart anything as holy, all of this was in the care of Shelomoth and his relatives. So these, again, these are kings, these are guys who have dedicated things to God, and somebody's got to guard them. And again, this isn't, these guys aren't the leftovers. As for the Israelites, Chenaniah and his sons were assigned to the outside work for Israel as officers and judges. All right, so these are guys who are making decisions. They're making administrative decisions, and judges, they're actually deciding law as to how the law is applied. As for the Hebronites, Hashabiah and his relatives, 1,700 men of valor who were over the administration of Israel across the Jordan to the west, for all the work of Yahweh and the service of the king. So again, men of valor, these are men who have demonstrated faithfulness, and they are officers and administrators. And it's on both sides of the Jordan. If you go down to verse 32, you've got 2,700, and David, King David made them overseers of the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of the Manassites. So where are those guys? Where's Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh? Yeah, they're on the east side of Jordan. They didn't remember, you know, they decided, hey, this is great for our place. We'd like to stay here. And then they sent their men over to fight so that the other tribes could get their inheritance, but they're over on the east side of the Jordan. And then David splits up the army. So rather than have a standing army all the time of everybody, he splits them up to where you're going to do a month on duty at a time. And there's going to be 24,000 of you. And who's over the people of the army? If you go through and you look at those names, a lot of those names you're going to recognize, because those are David's mighty men. Now, some of them are already dead. So, for instance, when you go down 27:7, the fourth for the fourth month was Asahel, the brother of Joab, and Zebediah, his son, after him. Well, when did Asahel die? Anybody remember? And who killed him? Joab's his brother. And Joab took revenge on him.
Right.
Abner killed him. Because again, they're having a battle, and Abner, and in fact, did Abner want to kill him? No. Asahel's trying to chase him down. Abner's trying to tell him, listen, stop. Go the other way. Go get somebody else. Don't come after me. And Asahel said, nope. I'm coming for you. And so Abner killed him. And then Joab, his brother, Asahel's brother, murdered Abner deceitfully. And so, in fact, which is why David is going to have Joab killed, because Joab murdered Abner. So, again, these are the commanders, well, they sure seem to be qualified. And the officers and the judges, well, they sure seem to be qualified. So it's, again, it's David's putting the cream of the crop in places where they're going to be able to do the best job. Then he lists in chapter 27, he lists the chief officers of the tribes. And then you've got these guys who were in charge of David's stuff. And David's got fields, he's got orchards, he's got vineyards, he's got warehouses, he's got storage facilities, he's got all of that. And then it lists the counselors. This has always struck me. Jonathan, David's uncle, was a counselor, a man of understanding and a scribe. And Jehiel, the son of Hachmonai, was with the king's sons. Ahithophel was counselor to the king, and Hushai the Archite was the king's friend. Now that's got to be pretty cool. You know, when I'm the king's friend.
Wasn't Ahithophel? Who was Bathsheba's father?
I don't remember that, but Ahithophel...
Anyway, there was Ahithophel strikes me as somebody that was, there was a connection.
Well, Ahithophel ended up becoming a counselor, I think it was to Absalom.
That's what it was.
And
he ended up on the wrong side.
He did. And he did. And again, the chronicler, well, he blazes over, he doesn't talk about that. You guys can talk about that one. In fact, Ahithophel was the one who was telling Absalom, you better keep after David. If you give him a chance to breathe, he's going to kill you. He's going to defeat you. And in fact, what was David hoping for? That they would not pay heed to Ahithophel's counsel.
Let me throw out in the public school system, if we go through a well-ordered civics
and Norman background, we get the idea that Rome, you had the really, they had all the bases covered as far as a government. And now we're seeing about 900 years before how David, through God's leading, had all the bases covered for a government, for a growing, growing civilization. The nation, the seedbed of a civilization, came through David and through the positions and the orderly way that he put together a government with all the bases covered.
Well, and again, yes, what are you hoping for when you've got counselors?
Honest.
Yeah, that you have good counselors. Solomon's son is going to run into that, right? Because Solomon, if he listened to the guys who were the counselors for his father, Rehoboam, if Rehoboam listened to the counselors for his dad, they told him one thing. But then he brings in the guys that are his peers, and they tell him something entirely different. So, you know, when the Bible talks about, you know, bad company corrupts good morals, that's true. Right.
Even Solomon, after a while, it goes into too much of a need. How many chariots can I collect? How many horses? How many concubines? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And so, again, it's, you can see, though, and again, that's where, because there's the level of detail here that's included, you can look and you can start to see, oh, wait a minute, now this, you can see how David is thinking, and you can see how that is influencing the choices that he's making. And so again, it's, we just glossed over several chapters of names. We did. I admit. Because many of those names, Chronicles is the only place you find them. And in fact, these chapters, that's the only place you find them. That information is here. And so, but the point being is that when you do the things, when God says, look, here's how you should think. Here's how you should act. Here's what you should believe. And then you see where men take and they take God at his word. You can see the fruit of that. You can also see where they don't take God and his word. You can also see the fruit of that. And so David is going through and he's trying to grease the skids for Solomon.
What do you make of the fact that David has available to him throughout his government, as it lists here, literally thousands of men of valor, men of integrity. They're everywhere in the military, in the service, in the temple, preparation, you know, in the judiciary, and compare that, and that's God's blessing, and compare that, I don't know, to our world in 2024. If you look at our governance around the world, you couldn't name five men of valor or integrity, it seems like, in the leadership of the entire world. You know, does that speak to what God's judgment on the situation today, as opposed to how he was blessing in multiple ways David's government?
Well, he is blessing David's government, and I mean, let's, leadership, if you're going to take one word, synonym for leadership, what is it? What is leadership?
Followership.
Okay? Leadership is about influence. That's what leadership is about. Part of the reason you would have organizations that are marked by corruption and infidelity is because that's what's led. That's what's taught. That's what is encouraged. Versus when you look and you see now, here's a man of integrity. Well, who's going to follow this guy? Typically not the riffraff. Because they're going to get exposed. And so when you have... now, that's not a hard and fast rule. But it is a good general principle that when you, if you want to have men like this, well, then you need to have leadership that promotes what it is that you want, which what it is that you're hoping to grow. And so, I think that when you look at David's administration, they are the way that they are because they're a reflection of him. You know, a man who's capable of great error, of great sin, yet who is also a man of great repentance and humility. And so, again, it's the bigger you are, the more chance of disaster you have. You know, I'm not going to be able to cause a national disaster. I don't have national influence. So I'm not going to be able to do that. You have to be, you know, in a position of, you know, where that is in your sphere of influence in order to have those kinds of effects. But if you want people of a certain character, then that's what you model for them. That's one of the things that I've appreciated so much about Alan and Dave over the years here. Very rarely do you have a church to where you have pretty much unlimited access to the pastors. And it's not just because you can make an appointment to see them in their office. I've hunted with them. I've fished with them. You know, we've done a lot of things together to where it's, you know, in the midst of doing such and such, then you can have conversations like, hey, what do you think about such and such? And I'll tell you something else I've appreciated about them. I can remember a number of conversations where it was, hey, what do you think about such and such? And, well, if it's something that they've studied, you know what, I've looked into that and this is what I found. But the other one that I remember very much with them, I've never studied that myself. But this is my understanding of it. So, I mean, there's some couching that goes there. So I have appreciated that here. And you know what? That gets reflected. Because now you have the leadership and training. And who teaches the leadership and training, by the way? Yeah, Dave and Charles do. Brian's helping do the counseling because Brian's got some background in that. So, you know, here you have... It's leadership by example, and frankly, which means you can have followingship, to use your term, by example. I can follow. So what would be the New Testament equivalent of that? Paul says it a couple of times. And exceedingly, I don't know about you, I find it to be an exceedingly intimidating statement.
Follow me as I follow Christ.
Yeah, follow me as I follow Christ. Ooh. Then that means I'd better be about what? I'd better be minding my P's and Q's. And so...
If you have a fish sticker on your car, you better be a good driver.
Yeah.
And you don't put a sticker on the back of your car that says Jesus is first. Lord, yeah. And then cut in front of somebody.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway. All right, let's pray. Father, thank you for the example that you've given us of David. Things that he does well. And frankly, he does them well because he trusted you. He knew your word. And when he strayed, he was quick to turn back. And he was enthusiastic in his service for you. He was not laid back. He was exuberant. He was all in service for you. And Lord, help us to be able to emulate that. That we would not be those who are laid back. That we would not be those that are timid. But that we would be bold for you. That we would be speakers of your truth. That we would be examples of your truth. That we would not, you know, have to tell other people, do as I say, not as I do. So help us to be doers of your word. And help us to be good examples to those that are watching. Thank you for your word and thank you for your spirit who enables us to understand what it is that you say. In Christ's name, amen. Thank you.